You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 20th of February 2019 on Monocle 24. Live from Midori House in London, this is the Monocle Daily. I'm Paul Osborne. Coming up,
the right wing, the hardline anti-EU awkward squad that have destroyed every leader for the last 40 years. Are now running the Conservative Party from top to toe.
A damning parting shot from MP Anna Soubry signals another bad day for Theresa May, though are there any other kind for Britain's embattled Prime Minister? Today, she holds Brexit talks in Brussels, hours after three of her MPs, including Soubry, quit her party. We'll get an update in just a moment. Ahead of European elections later this year, Twitter promises to act against online interference. But will these new rules make any difference? One European leader Donald Trump probably does like at the White House today. We'll learn more about the visit of Austria's anti-immigrant chancellor. And later on, why has CNN hired a former Trump administration staffer as a political editor? Plus, we'll hear from an acclaimed French film director and get the top stories from Asia. All in the next hour on the Monocle Daily, live from London on Monocle 24. Well, welcome to tonight's Monocle Daily. Theresa May probably didn't have an especially enjoyable trip to Brussels today. Apart from the impending talks with EU leaders to try to ease her never-ending Brexit crisis, she had spent the day dealing with the departure of three of her MPs. They have quit the Conservative Party to join a new independent group sitting on the opposition benches in the House of Commons. All this as the Prime Minister tries to wring concessions from the EU that officials there have repeatedly insisted are not possible. Well, we're going to explore this in the next few minutes. We'll start in Brussels with Euronews correspondent Darren McCaffrey, who's on the line. So, Darren, Mrs. May travelling there saying she still wants changes to the Irish backstop. The EU still saying that's not on the table.
It's still saying no. Yes, a constructive meeting, we were told, between Theresa May and Jean-Claude Juncker tonight, as you say, as she seeks to win those changes to her Brexit agreement. She's hoping to win those legally binding changes to the backstop, which is, of course, contained within the EU's withdrawal agreement. Clearly the main concern of MPs when they rejected her deal in a record defeat for the government back in January. Now, did anything significant come from tonight? In many ways, not. We were told beforehand this wouldn't be a breakthrough moment. I think I tweeted out saying that this was kicking the can further down the road, of which I got a response from someone saying we should stop using that, but rather this was the long and winding road to the end of March. And it does seem that this is continually part of the strategy of Theresa May, and potentially it must be said of the European Union, to try and leave this to the last possible moment, giving MPs a choice at the end of March, with what potentially mere days or a week before Britain is due to leave, with the choice of having to accept her deal with some changes, it must be said, or no deal, which we know the majority of MPs in Parliament have already stated they're against. So what can she get? Well, we know that the UK Attorney General is also over here. They're looking at essentially some form of guarantees. What form and how legally binding they will be is obviously what is being trying to be negotiated. But it looks like a protocol might well be added on to the withdrawal agreement rather than opening it up, while, of course, trying also to deal with a future trading relationship, something that would avoid the backstop being in place for a long period of time, that they're looking at that political declaration and seeing what could be achieved there.
Darren, I mean, many people have said that that's the plan, actually, on both sides of this, the EU and the UK, is to extend this until just a few days before Brexit, in the hope that you can effectively kind of bully MPs into voting for whatever deal is available out of fear of the alternative. If that is the plan, it's an incredibly high-risk strategy, given the seeming collapse of discipline across the parties.
It is indeed, and it may not work. And even what we've seen in Westminster today, and we heard from Dr. Sarah Wollaston, one of those Conservative MPs that left the party, is that she already thought that this strategy of kicking the can down the road to the last possible moment was too big a risk, and that essentially she was leaving the party because of that. And we do know or at least it is rumoured, that there are ministers, potentially even cabinet ministers, who in the next week or two will have to face that decision, that if they think this is what Theresa May is trying to do, that it may be too big a gamble even for them, and that they could walk out of the cabinet or resign as ministers. And again, that makes Theresa May's position incredibly difficult, because she cannot in some ways rule out no deal, in the sense that in order to avoid no deal, there has to be a deal in place. And if MPs aren't willing to accept that, the only other way is to extend Article 50, potentially for a long period of time. And in doing that, of course, while she might keep those kind of soft remainers in place in the government, keep them happy, she then, of course, risks the wrath of the Brexiteers, who would not want to see a long extension to Article 50. So yet again, we are where Theresa May are, which is between a rock and a hard place in these negotiations.
As if the EU weren't sort of bemused and exasperated enough, I mean, what's the perception in Brussels of the latest events, of these defections from the Conservative Party?
I think there is a surprise in some ways, because people, when you talk to them here, and I've been speaking to MEPs all day today, have always looked at Britain's political system as incredibly stable. People in Europe are used to fractured politics, to governments changing, to coalitions, but not in Britain. And actually, they're looking at this process, and they're looking at some ways at the disintegration of the norms of British politics. But also, there's just a real sense of frustration here that Britain, even yet, with what, 37 days to go, still don't really have a clear idea of what it wants, of what could go through at the House of Commons. And of course, the fear from the European Union's point of view is that, yes, they act, that they do give some ground, and I suspect they will give a little, but they do give ground, and that simply still will not be enough. And today's resignations, along with yesterday's, just re-emphasise that this idea that Theresa May says that she can provide a stable and substantial majority for something seems incredibly weakened when she cannot even keep some of her own MPs in her own party.
Darren, thanks very much. Euro News correspondent Darren McCaffrey, who's in Brussels. With me here in the studio is Joe Ladika, who's a columnist for London's Evening Standard newspaper. Just starting with those three defections from the Conservative Party today, we heard from one of the people who's left the Tory party, Anna Soubry, at the top of the programme. The timing of this was designed to be as damaging as possible to the person who, until just then, had been their party leader. An hour before Prime Minister's questions and just before she gets on the Eurostar to head over to Brussels. I mean, they couldn't have picked a more damaging time to do it.
Well, so the defections come in two ways. First of all, it started with Labour on Monday, 10 o'clock, and they couldn't, I think, have walked out at exactly the same time as the Labour group. The Labour group stood up, and their casus belli was anti-Semitism. And it's quite a clever way of, they've tacked on the we'd like a people's vote onto the sort of second tier of that. But it's so clear that anti-Semitism has become a significant problem within the Labour Party, however much Jeremy Corbyn denies it. So they had to come in a second wave. And yes, the timing was absolutely beautiful. I mean, the other thing they could have done is actually literally got up in Prime Minister's question time and crossed the floor, which has happened, I think, of 60-odd times in sort of relatively recent British history. It's not unheard of. But for three of them to walk across, what they actually decided to do was set out their position 1 hour before, so the Twitter engines start turning, the news engines start turning, so Theresa May knows what she's going to face when it comes to Prime Minister's questions. What was odd for everybody watching it, and I'm sure that Theresa May's PMQ's scriptwriters had prepared an attack on Jeremy Corbyn for having lost seven, by then eight, members of his party, probably scribbling that out of the script. And in fact, neither of the leaders of the major parties mentioned it. It was like the sort of incredibly kind of embarrassed British thing where, in fact, there were all sorts of local questions about local issues and health matters, but no mention of the fact they both lost a significant a section of their MPs.
You mentioned the motivations that were given by the now eight Labour MPs who've left that party. They talked about the failure to tackle anti-Semitism. They talked about their opposition to Jeremy Corbyn's leadership. One person saying it would be irresponsible for Jeremy Corbyn to become prime minister. And there is anger there about Labour's handling of Brexit as well. So there are lots of different reasons for the Labour MPs to leave. But it seems that for the Conservatives, the issue is Brexit, is the hard right takeover, as they see it, of the Conservative Party and the failure on Brexit.
Yes, and I think there's a wider point, though, which is that unlike Labour, which has always been an ideological party and it moved sort of to a more pragmatic ground under Tony Blair and it's flipped back to hard left ideology under Jeremy Corbyn, the Conservatives have constantly styled themselves as, in a sense, non-ideological, or as Anna Soubry calls it, a kind of one nation Tory party. Everybody's in it together. And it has now moved from that rather flexible position to this position whereby Theresa May is having to continually do deals with the libertarian wing of the party, who do represent an ideology. And so their second reason for going, or their kind of equal reason for going, was that this Conservative Party no longer represents that kind of broad church of values. It has now become in hock to that particular wing of the party that also tried to bring down John Major. John Major managed to defeat them. Theresa May keeps doing business with them.
The issue for this new group, and I say it's not actually a political party yet, it's just an independent grouping of MPs, though it seems quite likely it's going to become a party, is that the electoral system in the UK is not kind to third parties. It's very, very difficult for third parties to break through. So even if they became a political party and they fielded candidates, they'd be fighting against the machines of those two big parties to get MPs.
There's one advantage at the moment for not being a party, which is they can accept donations without having to go through the rigours of the other parties have to check where the money has come from and whether it's legitimate. The minute they form into a party, that then becomes a far tougher regime. On the upside, if they did form a party, they would then get money for their electoral campaigns. Now, what you must bear in mind is that there is, in fact, a lot of money sloshing around in a kind of almost crowdfunding manner for a new political party. So you can see the weight of opinion in this country behind, for example, a people's vote. You could see when Momentum arrived how many people were willing to put money behind Jeremy Corbyn. These may not be big donors, these may just be small donors, but the minute they really open a kind of fundraising appeal, I think they'll find a significant tranche of this country would actually give money for this a third party. And that is without even bringing in big business who would really like to see remain for their own needs. Not every big business, but a large number of them.
Now, we had a new opinion poll published earlier today before the fieldwork was done, before we knew that these three people were leaving the Conservative Party as well, which put this new independent group at 14% support among voters if they fielded candidates in an election. But another 17% suddenly declared themselves as don't knows when asked who they would support. And that suggests that around about a third of the electorate, almost overnight, is open to persuasion, to voting for a party that at the moment doesn't technically exist.
It doesn't exist. It's pretty much a blank canvas on policies. It's very centrist. It's possibly pro-austerity, anti-nationalisation of industries. We don't really know what it embodies. But what I think you will find, somebody said, and I almost tweeted almost the same thing, it felt like a kind of window had been opened, a breath of fresh air had come into British politics. We have had this deadlock of two parties, neither of which will in any way cleave from the Brexit line. 48% of the voters in our referendum wanted to remain, and they've had no significant political representation in Parliament. And suddenly there's one high-profile group that is representing them. And so the energy in that poll you're seeing moving towards this blank canvas of an independent group, I think, is largely Remainers or, in some cases, Brexiteers who've seen the folly of their ways and saying, well, actually, I think we do need somebody to steer the ship in a different direction. Now, it's very difficult to kind of call what's going on in the country at the moment on the leave-remain argument, but there are consistently polls now showing more people would like to remain than leave.
We've been here before, of course, with the creation of the SDP in the 1980s, which was a breakaway from the Labour Party, which at one opinion poll had it at 51% support.
At one point it was absolutely skyrocketed, and then Falklands came in and then everything settled down yet again. So the interesting question here is, if Theresa May ends up, and this is not impossible, having to call an election, and if various scenarios play out and we just get into a total logjam, it may be that she does indeed have to go back to the country. She's now, was it about, in that latest poll, about 38%. Labour's down on 26%. So she might sit there thinking, well, on that calculation, we would do that. They've been damaged by anti-Semitism. We should probably go for it. But then when you start seeing a new grouping coming together that may form a political party, it could kick the heels out of both those parties. And this dual party system we've had, which has only had, you know, a Lib Dem coalition briefly in recent history, could in fact actually splinter into a kind of European political system very quickly.
And when you talk about European political system, the obvious parallel when someone creates a new political movement is Emmanuel Macron in France. Mm. Is that what this is, or is this just a very British kind of polite, not much liking what we have, but putting up with it?
So they've all declared that they haven't formed into a solid party yet is interesting. They have all seemed to have left the door open to going back, particularly the Tories, if they were somehow accepted back in. There would have to be some sort of conversation in the background. A lot of people, I mean, Chuka in the past has been referred to as the British Obama. We've all been looking for a kind of British Macron. The trouble with the Macron reputation is that his reputation is absolutely tanked in no time at all, because speaking to the centre ground, you rapidly find that people there don't disagree and you still end up with these extremes on either side. So it's still fraught with danger. It may come to nothing. But I think significantly, there are talks of more defections, they're beginning to get to that point where they can begin to swing votes quite heavily and exert some influence on what is essentially a knife-edge parliament on almost every vote now.
Joe Ladeka, thank you very much for coming in this evening. And before, also to Darren McCaffrey in Brussels. Austria's Chancellor has been in Washington, D.C. We'll get an update on his talks in just a moment. First, though, let's take a quick look at some of the day's other main news stories. Civilians have been evacuated from the last village in Syria, still under the control of the Islamic State group. Hundreds of men, women and children were moved out of Baghouz near the Iraqi border. US-backed fighters say they were waiting for the civilians to be cleared before starting a final assault on the IS militants still holed up there. Bangladesh has said it will not allow a British teenager who fled to join IS in Syria to enter the country. That throws into question the UK's move to strip Shamima Begum of her British citizenship. Ministers said she was entitled to Bangladeshi citizenship too, meaning she wouldn't be left stateless. But Bangladesh has said there is no question of her being allowed in. And Russia's parliament has voted to ban soldiers from using smartphones while on duty. Officials say the move's needed to protect military information from foreign intelligence services. Information shared by soldiers on social media has enabled open-source journalists to expose secret Russian military activity in the past. This is the Monocle Daily. Now, it's 14 years since an Austrian chancellor was welcomed to the White House, but today Sebastian Kurz is there meeting Donald Trump. He's been praised by some inside the US administration, but to others he is an Islamophobe who has cozied up to the far right. So let's speak now to Cornelia Primosch, who's a correspondent for the Austrian Broadcasting Corporation based in London. As I say, 2005, the last time an Austrian chancellor was in the Oval Office. So this is a big deal for the country.
It's an absolutely big deal for Sebastian Kurz, who really likes to show himself next to the big leaders of the world. So he is absolutely happy it was his big day.
Now, Trump's ambassador, I think, in Germany described him at one stage as a rock star. And putting aside the controversies around his political views and his political partners, on that, he does have a point. He's very young to be leading a country, and he has risen to this position at some speed.
Absolutely. So this is, as a matter of fact, he's probably one of the youngest leaders internationally and pretty proud of himself, I imagine, that he is playing basically on the same level as the big leaders here. So, yes, he's absolutely aware of being a young leader, meeting the big animals.
It's perhaps a little simplistic to assume that Donald Trump is going to get on with a man who has made a lot of anti-immigrant statements in the past, who has had mosques in his country closed down and imams deported. But sticking to that simplistic assessment, it is quite likely they are going to have quite a lot in common.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'm sure that Mr. Kurz brought up today that he sort of was the one who closed the so-called Western Balkan route. That's like his political achievement, the big one. He was leading the election campaign 1.5 years ago. So this is his big thing. So they do have things in common. Absolutely, Mr. Trump is up to build a wall. Well, more or less successfully. Mr. Kurz is also quite in favor of walls. That's quite something where they got some common ground.
It's not necessarily plain sailing all the way, though, is it? Because Mr. Kurz wanted to bring up the issues of trade. And certainly before going into these talks, Donald Trump was again saying that he was willing to impose tariffs on, for example, car imports from the EU.
Yeah, as Kurz mentioned, like just after he has met Donald Trump, Mr. Trump has quite an issue with Germany. So apparently there's really something. Kurz was quite blunt when he spoke about it. He said Trump really has something against, is really angry with Germany. So that seemed like it was something really personal, you could get the impression. But yeah, so they definitely rose this issue. I mean, Kurz also wants to go back to Europe and say, look, I've spoken to him. We have quite a good, we're getting along well. So that's what I can tell you, fellow European prime ministers. So I guess, yeah. On the other hand, it's quite good that they are talking about it, that the Europeans and the US do are at least at the stage where they still talk about it instead of just starting a trade war or going on with a trade war.
Another big gap potentially between them is the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline from Russia. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump's talked about sanctions there. There is an Austrian company that is a major backer of it.
Absolutely. So Austria is, of course, behind this. Kurz mentioned after he has met Trump that Austria is very much interested in this Nord Stream, in this pipeline project. And what did he say? We need to heat our Austrian houses with gas. So he was definitely defending this project. And Donald Trump is very, very much is very angry about it, not keen at all. And they brought it up and they talked about it. But I sensed basically that this wasn't a very, very friendly encounter between the two of them. So Kurz said it was controversial, which is quite a strong word in the diplomatic language, isn't it?
I'm wondering what counts as success for him from this meeting. I mean, obviously there's going to Washington, there's the photographs, there's the news conference with the president, all those kind of things. But what you mentioned, what he wanted to take back to other EU leaders, what will he want to take back home from this and parade to voters in Austria as a success?
Well, look, Sebastian Kurz, he has met, four times already, Vladimir Putin. So definitely he also needs to show, I can't only have good talks and a good relationship with Vladimir Putin, but also with Donald Trump. So I'm basically the one he likes to set himself up he calls himself a bridge builder. So he's constructing bridges, the one who is seeking dialogue and enabling dialogue, basically. And as a matter of fact, after having met Putin already four times, it was just a question of time that he had to meet also, the question is Trump really Putin's counterpart? As a matter of fact, he also had to meet the US leader, the other side of the equilibrium of power, isn't it? So Kurz, what he actually wants, he would like to see himself as the one who is bringing people together. Let's see whether he succeeded or not.
Cornelia, thank you very much. Cornelia Promosh there on the visit of the Austrian Chancellor to Washington, D.C. You're listening to Monocle 24.
The pendulum is a-swinging, and these days it's the city of Paris that's turning heads with retail innovation. Monocle Films travel to the 16th arrondissement to sample Le Bon Marché's new addition to La Grande Épicerie family.
Food is a lot of memory. It's memory with your mother, with your grandmother. Food, it's a pleasure. You have to find this game with a product. I try in the architecture to have this sensibility.
For a filmic tour of La Grande Épicerie, Rive Droite, head to monocle.com.
Now, it's no revelation to say that Donald Trump is not a fan of CNN, but it's possible the US president is a little more approving of its latest hire. A longtime Republican operative is to join the network as a political editor. It sparked questions over the motives behind the decision. Well, let's speak now to Adam Ragusa, who's a visiting assistant professor at the Mercy University Centre for Collaborative Journalism and is on the line now. Adam, first of all, tell us about this new hire at CNN. Who is she?
Sarah Isger Flores is a longtime Republican operative with a very distinguished resume. She's really worked on a lot of campaigns, generally worked for those Republican candidates whom even some Democrats might begrudgingly admire, people like Mitt Romney, generally moderates. The more moderate and intellectual side of the party tends to be her party. And she's worked on a whole bunch of campaigns. She's also done some teaching. She did a fellowship at the Harvard Kennedy School in 2016. And most recently, she was the spokesperson for our attorney general here in the States, Jeff Sessions. And I don't know, of all of the people whom CNN could hire, maybe President Trump would give a bit of a more approval to Sarah Isger Flores. But I don't know if he'd be thrilled, because the president and his now former attorney general, Jeff Sessions, had a terrible relationship. And a lot of Republicans, a lot of Trump supporters are actually viewing Isger's hiring at CNN just as suspiciously, perhaps even more so, than liberals who are upset about a Republican operative making her way into a news network that, positioned itself as sort of the middle of the road until relatively recently and has really become an antagonist of the Trump administration.
Well, indeed, at first look, many people have interpreted this in that way, as CNN has this perhaps problem with some of its audience that it is perceived as nakedly anti-Trump. So why not hire someone who's had a job in the Trump administration?
Well, they've hired people before. They hired Corey Lewandowski, who was President Trump's campaign manager during his campaign. But that was different, right? They hired Corey Lewandowski as I don't know what the title was, but as a commentator, right? As somebody to come onto talk shows and give a nakedly partisan opinion. That's very different from the job that Isger has been hired for, which is as a political editor. That is to say, someone who is directing coverage, probably giving assignments to reporters and editing stories, and also going on TV from time to time to talk about the news. And that's different, right? For a number of reasons that are troubling to people, although I'm not totally sure that they should be troubled by it. I actually think this is a good hire.
And there is a long history of this revolving door between politics and TV news. There are lots of people who've gone from high-flying political jobs on all sides to on-air and off-air jobs in television.
Sure. The most prominent example in the States at the moment would probably be George Stephanopoulos, who was a longtime staffer of former President Bill Clinton, left the Clinton administration in the 90s, and then got a job again as an on-air analyst, a political commentator for ABC News in the States, and over a period of several years sort of climbed the ladder and stopped just being a pundit and eventually became an anchor, first of their Sunday morning political talk show This Week. And now he's the chief anchor of the entire network. And so a lot of people who are defending CNN's move to hire Isger are pointing to ABC's hiring of Stephanopoulos and saying, look, this is the same thing. Why weren't you upset about this? And I'd have two responses for it. One, some of us were upset about George Stephanopoulos. And two, George Stephanopoulos's transition from politics to media was much more gradual, right? He started as a commentator, and then he gradually moved into a more traditionally impartial role of anchor. Sarah Isger Flores is going directly from being a political operative to being an editor, a behind-the-scenes decision maker about news and doing hard news. That's a very, very quick and rather awkward transition, and I understand why people are a little bit freaked out about it. press media people and political people necessarily have a bit of an adversarial relationship, or at least they should. They're a bit like foes in a conflict. And in war, I imagine that if you accept a defector into your camp, you probably don't give them a rifle right away. There is an adjustment period in which you make sure that you can really trust this former foe who claims to have converted to your side. And a lot of people could interpret this as CNN just giving Sara Isger Flores a rifle straight out the gate. But for what it's worth, I think that's a little bit alarmist. This is a really, really smart person. If people are skeptical about her, I would really encourage you to go on YouTube and watch an interview that she did with the Harvard Political Review in 2016 during her fellowship at the Kennedy School. This is a very, very thoughtful person. She's very thoughtfully implicitly criticizes President Trump in that interview, implicitly criticize him by criticizing the media for rewarding stupid antics with coverage instead of rewarding, you know, thoughtful policy with coverage. And by the way, she's absolutely right about that. This is a person who has a lot to offer. And if you believe that ideological diversity is important in newsrooms, that's a big if. I've actually not made up my own mind. but if you believe that ideological diversity is important in newsrooms, then, you know, of all of the sort of conservative hires that CNN could have made for its political reporting, like this is a good one.
CNN has been at pains to subsequently point out that she will not be leading their political coverage. She will not be making big decisions about 2020 election coverage, for example.
Well, she won't be the sole decider, they have said. Yeah, she'll be one of several editors.
But that seems to be a response to some of this criticism, but they must have expected this kind of pushback.
I suppose. But, you know, they can't do anything without getting yelled at by somebody. This is just how it works in the news business. We both know that, right, Paul?
Well, absolutely. You can't please all of the people. You can't please many of the people, to be honest. Adam, thank you. Adam Ragusea from the Mercer University Center for Collaborative Journalism. You're listening to Monocle 24. Now, this year's European elections were always going to be a test of efforts to counter the impact of questionable online political advertising. But now Twitter has announced plans to bring in extra checks on political ads in Europe. From next month, there'll be more information about who's paid for them and who the adverts are targeting. But will it make any difference? Well, I'm joined now by Laura Cowley, who's a tech reporter for Politico Europe and is based in Brussels. First of all, Laura, just tell us a little more about what it is that Twitter is planning to do.
Well, they're planning to extend the policy that currently applies in the US, which means that, first of all, advertisers will have to be certified to make sure that they are indeed EU-based. So non-EU entities will not be allowed to advertise during the EU election.
They'll have to prove they're based inside the EU, but presumably you could be a company based in Germany or France, say, but operating on instruction from, for the sake of argument, Russia, and that will be quite difficult to spot.
I guess that's one of the limits of the ad transparency tool that they will develop. But it will prevent foreign actors from trying to influence voters from abroad. So they will tackle the main, the heaviest disinformation efforts. Because to have an entity based in the EU requires extra effort. So not everyone will be able to do it. So with this policy, you will at least prevent some of the disinformation efforts.
Now, how cheerfully is Twitter doing all of this? Because it was only a few weeks ago the EU threatened to bring in regulations on tech firms if they didn't act against disinformation.
Well, it has been in the making for several weeks. They've been talking about it for several weeks. Now they're actually trying to implement it, but they are aware that this is a problem. And what the European Commission emphasized when they said that their companies had to do more, it was also on cooperation with fact-checkers, with opening the APIs for researchers and tools for citizens. Because the code of practice on disinformation that the European Commission is implementing is not only about ads. There are a lot of of things that companies have to do, and ads is only one part of it.
Are tech companies, though, even necessarily equipped to win this battle? And I know this, it often feels as if they are playing catch up with people who understand the tech behind these sites like Twitter better than the people who own them.
Well, of course, everyone is on a reactive mode more than a proactive mode, I would say. But the responsibility also falls on users, and that's why companies also try to promote media literacy, because in order to fake news to be efficient, on the far end you have to for the users to believe them. So it's also this media literacy effort that also the European Commission has emphasized, that everyone kind of has to play a role in this.
That is one of the problems, isn't it? That you can put rules in place to limit some of these things, but fundamentally, people want to put misleading adverts online. They can, in the same way that partisan groups were able to put misleading claims into posters or into newspaper adverts. There is, to some extent, a responsibility on voters to approach those claims with a bit of scepticism.
Exactly, and to be informed with the different outlets and to try to do a bit of research on the source, etc. So, I mean, at the end of the day, it's voters who vote and who also have a role in this.
Is there a fear that these new rules could be applied a little over-enthusiastically and to sort of make a point about a crackdown, and that in the process, people who are legitimately entitled to participate in these type of debates and to advertise in this way might be denied that platform?
Not really, because I don't know about Twitter specifically, but for Google, for instance, they will allow cross-border ads within the EU. So if a German party, for example, wants to advertise in France during the European election, this will be possible. So Europeans will be able to advertise within Europe.
Laura, thank you very much. Laura Kayali there from Politico Europe. You're with The Daily from Monocle 24. Still to come tonight, a French film, Thai politicians turning to clairvoyance. And in just a moment, we'll head to Helsinki. Because in the Finnish capital, it is well past midnight. The theatres will long since have emptied out, but we're heading to one anyway as we explore the history of one of Finland's modernist icons, Helsinki's City Theatre. Here's our correspondent, Petri Betsov.
When the architect Timo Penttilä was given the task of designing a new theatre for the city of Helsinki, the project seemed like every architect's dream. The city had an active drama scene, but it lacked a large landmark theatre building. Such was to be built in a large 1.5-hectare empty plot with an undulating topography by the sea in the suburb of Kallio. Finland at the time, in the 1960s, was at the architectural forefront of the world. Alvar Aalto had already earned his place in the pantheon of modernist masters alongside the likes of Le Corbusier and Mies van der Rohe. The eyes of the world's architecture lovers were on Finland. Although Penttilä was relatively unknown at the time, the societal role of the architect was at its height. He was given a carte blanche when designing the building. Penttilä decided to adopt a functionalist approach where, as the name suggests, function was to dictate the form. The theatre halls were placed horizontally because a multi-storied approach would have made stage logistics more difficult. This design resulted in a flat edifice that blends into the surrounding park and hills, hugging the topography around the building, as one architecture historian wrote. The theatre halls are partly underground, carved into the bedrock of the area, so that approaching the building from behind, it is only a few meters tall and very unassuming. This stands in stark contrast to the large foyer that dominates the main seaside facade. Its glass walls and low-rise design are the theatre's main defining feature. Inside the theatre building, white slabs of marble intersect with elements of natural wood and brass in a space filled with natural light and views of the surrounding parkland. This design is very typical of modernism and sort of blends the boundary of the inside and the outside of the building. But for Penttilä, it had another rationale. The openness of the light-filled foyer, with its grandiose views over the sea and the surrounding parkland, stands in contrast with the closed theatre halls. This juxtaposition of light and dark, the open space and the closed space, accentuates the role of the performance. But more importantly, the foyer acts as a kind of intermediary between the theatre stage and the surrounding city, again accentuating the theatre as a social space not detached from the urban fabric of the city. There is a monumentalism present in the Helsinki City Theatre's design that was not typical of the modernist buildings of the time. Penttilä himself was critical of the carbon copy architecture of the post-war years that eschewed the role of the building as a monument, seeing its inherent value solely in the function that it serves. For Penttilä, buildings had a monumental value beyond their practical use value. Buildings, he believed, were monuments that shaped the identity of the city. Helsinki City Theatre became more than a monument. It became an icon. It was the finest theatre of its time and is widely considered Penttilä's finest design. It was a career-defining work for Penttilä, who at the time was a relatively unknown Finnish architect. After its completion, Penttilä was hired to teach architecture at the Berkeley University in California and later worked for almost two decades at the prestigious Viennese Akademie der Bildenden Künsten. In terms of functionality, the Helsinki City Theatre has stood the test of time. It is today Finland's biggest professional theatre, with nearly 1,000 performances per year, and is passionately loved by the theatre's employees. The building was carefully and painstakingly restored for its 50-year jubilee 2 years ago by the Helsinki-based LPR architects, who wanted to modernize the building's technology without altering Penttilä's original design. The renovated theatre can host the most technologically advanced plays and musicals, but stepping into the building is like stepping into a time machine. The Helsinki City Theatre is today considered one of the defining buildings of Finnish modernism, alongside such masterpieces as Alvar Aalto's Finlandia Hall and Jäntien Lindegren's Helsinki Olympic Stadium.
Petri Bertsov there. Don't forget, more stories of our cities in the Urbanist premieres at 1900 London time tomorrow here on Monocle 24, anytime after that at monocle.com. Stay with us in just a moment, some of the top stories across Asia.
On Meet the Writers this week, join me, Georgina Godwin, as I talk to Scandinavia's hottest new novelist, Niklas Natt-Ochdach. His name means night and day, and he's a member of Sweden's oldest existing noble family. A journalist, his debut novel, entitled 1793 in Swedish and The Wolf and the Watchman in English, has been a huge hit domestically and is now taking the rest of the world by storm. That's Niklas Natt-Ochdach on Meet the Writers, premiering this Saturday at 1500 London time and thereafter available as a podcast.
Well, it's time now to look at some of the stories that are making headlines across Asia today. My guest in the studio, Michael Bieler, who's a lecturer in comparative politics at SOAS, the University of London. Michael, thank you for coming in this evening. We begin with rumours that there could be a snap election on the way in Singapore.
Yeah, so the Asia Times basically published an article today about a new budget being announced by Singapore's finance minister. And so the budget is very expansionary and basically has put down a lot of money for public services that help the elderly, for instance. And so people have seen that as an indication for snap elections, which would, if that's really the case, happen almost a year before actually elections would have to be held according to Singaporean law.
If that does happen, why would they be going for an early election?
Well, right now, probably they're hedging against, future risks. So we have an election come up in Indonesia in April 2019. And so the Indonesian government has become increasingly nationalistic. So that has had impacts on trade relationships between Singapore and Indonesia. And so probably the situation is going to deteriorate over the next 18 months or so with regard to the global economy. And so therefore, probably the Singaporean government would like to have these elections right now.
Moving on, there are plans to bring in a tourist tax in Bali.
Yeah, so basically the Balinese provincial government has come up with a new tourist tax. So basically everyone going to Bali now will have to pay 10 US dollars or the equivalent of that. And that then should be used to do something about environmental degradation in Bali. Just this week, there was a report here in The Guardian, I believe, about how plastic waste has now become such a problem in Bali that basically tourists stay away. And the article basically suggests that this tax should then finance some of the cleaning up.
There is that question, isn't there? Whenever you introduce a tax, is then where's the money going to go? Is it going to, if you say we're going to do this to clean up the environment, the impact of the tourists, then it ends up sort of disappearing in a different direction somehow.
Oh, absolutely. I don't think much will come of it, because already now, if you actually leave Bali, you already pay the equivalent of $20. That also should go into the protection of local cultures and the environment, and nothing really has happened. And as you just said, Indonesia, of course, is notorious for corruption and bad governance. And so we'll see whether this really will have an impact. But for the time being, a new charge is being levied on tourists going to Bali.
Now, questions about the often very tough policies that are adopted in Asia on illegal drugs.
Yeah, so José Ramos Horta, who is a Nobel Peace Prize winner and a former politician of East Timor, has written quite an interesting op-ed in the South China Morning Post, where he basically says that the war on drugs, so to speak, in Southeast Asia has not been successful at all, and basically has made the situation worse for many people on the ground. And so why does he write this op-ed right now? Because in the next couple of months, the United Nations will come together to come up with a new plan to fight drugs in Asia. And so he basically says a new approach is needed, because the kind of criminalization of drugs we've seen in the last two decades or so has not really had any positive impact.
It would be a big shift, though, wouldn't it, for these countries to say, I mean, it's the thing that everybody knows, everybody's warned when you go on holiday to Southeast Asia, is like, just remember, tiny things that would get you ticking off by the police will land you in jail for X number of years. And it would be a big change then to reverse those policies.
Oh, absolutely. And, what's quite ironic about the article here is that, of course, a lot of these conservative drug policies in Southeast Asia have been implemented after the United Nations has actually pushed a very conservative drug policy over the last couple of decades, which in itself has been financed by the United States, which also have a very conservative stance towards drugs. And so in many ways, this does not require just local governments to change their attitude towards drugs and basically shift from a criminalization of drug consumption to harms reduction, but it would also probably need a rethinking here in the West, especially the United States.
I was speaking to someone a couple of days ago who broke their foot in Thailand a few weeks ago while kickboxing.
Right.
And said that once they got out of the hospital, they sort of headed to a pharmacy where they were offered over-the-counter morphine. Just, would you like to buy some morphine? And she said, in a country where tourists are handed out the death penalty for drug offences. It's sort of a very odd double standard in a way that you can go to a chemist and just go, I'd like some morphine, please.
Oh, I mean, a lot of this stuff is widely available. And of course, local governments are complicit in all of this. I mean, crystal meth, for instance, is widespread in Southeast Asia and is directly related to the economic boom we've seen over the last couple of decades. So not only do we now have a middle class that has money to spend, but at the same time, a lot of the people in Southeast Asia are increasingly pushed by economic pressures to basically work long hours. And so a lot of them, they basically then take drugs such as crystal meth. I mean, if you talk to drug drivers or airplane pilots as well, a lot of them are actually on crystal meth in Southeast Asia. So there also is a relationship here to poor protection of workers and poor labor laws. And so if that would be improved, probably less people would have to resort to morphium or crystal meth.
I'm going to try not to think too much about the idea of a pilot
pilot on crystal meth as we move on to another story about Thai politics, because as if politics in Thailand wasn't chaotic enough, now some of its practitioners are turning to clairvoyance for help.
Yeah, so apparently they're making a killing, fortune tellers in Thailand, because we have an election come up on the 24th of March, but no one really knows what will actually happen. We've had, as you know, last week, an attempt by the princess of Thailand to basically participate in these elections as candidates. Her older brother then intervened. And so basically now there's all sorts of rumors about whether the opposition parties will be banned. There's also rumors about a coup within the military to get rid of Prayut, and so fortune tellers apparently are now in high demand because people want to know what happens after the 24th of March 2019.
Fortune tellers are being consulted. They don't happen to do a line in Brexit as well, do they?
I mean, that will probably be, some consulting opportunities there for Southeast Asian fortune tellers. But there's a long history of these kind of stories in Southeast Asia. I mean, in the 1980s, for instance, Burma changed its money overnight because a fortune teller had told the then dictator Ne Win that he has a certain series of lucky numbers, which he then turned into the local currency, wiping out the savings of the entire country. And so in Thailand, similar stories. There that also politicians actually quite frequently consult fortune tellers, and so I'm sure it's not just people on the streets, but then also people like Prayut probably talking to fortune tellers to see what their chances are to actually survive these upcoming elections.
I mean, I appreciate that obviously in a country where there is a tendency to do that, and so it isn't maybe viewed in the same way that it would be viewed here, but I'm just trying to imagine what the pub reaction of voters will be to a British politician who said, I've been consulting, I've been looking at my horoscope in the paper, I've been to, you know, the crystal ball to find out if I'm going to win or not. I don't think that would inspire much confidence.
Increasingly feels like that. If you look at the Brexit debate, that's probably informed by all sorts of non-experts. But I think Nancy Reagan would actually frequently consult fortune tellers when Ronald Reagan was in power and sort of try to figure out how she could advise her husband.
Well, there we are. There's nothing to be alarmed about there. Politicians relying on clairvoyance and fortune tellers. Michael Buehler, thank you very much for your time this evening. You're listening to The Daily from Monocle 24. Now, lastly this evening, we open the pages of the latest issue of Monocle magazine, which is devoted to France. It includes a roundup of the best French cinema of recent years. Among the list is L'Amant Double from the director François Ozon. It featured at Cannes 2 years ago. Monocle's Ben Ryland spoke to Ozon, asking what appealed about the original story by Joyce Carol Oates.
Actually, I'm a big fan of Joyce Carol Oates, and I've read many of her books. And she's a graphomaniac. She has written so many books, I think more than 100 books. And one day, reading a review about, I learned that she had a pseudonym, and she was used to writing some books with the pseudonym of Rosamund Smith. And so I was very curious to know that she had two names and what kind of book she was writing under a pseudonym. And I discovered this book, The Lives of the Twins, and I really enjoyed it. I thought it was funny, sexy, and it was an erotic thriller. And it was something I wanted to make for a long time as a film. So I worked on it, and I made an adaptation, and I realized already the American made an adaptation in the 80s on television with Isabella Rossellini and Aidan Quinn. And I saw the film and it was terrible. So I said, it's easy to make better.
This concept of duality then runs right through the text then, because of course it is about, shall we say, a fascination with twins. Yeah. The concept of what it means to be a twin, or what it means to want to be a twin perhaps, runs through the whole film. What was it about the whole twin aspect that really stuck out at you?
I have always been fascinated by twins. I don't have a twin, but I would have loved to have a twin. I have one brother and two sisters. And I think as a normal guy, actually, I'm always interesting to meet twins because we have always many questions to ask them, because it's so curious to see people who have the same appearance. And to know what kind of games they had together when they were children or young people, especially about sexuality. I think I have a big curiosity about that. So I was very interested to see what Joyce Carol Oates had to say about that. And actually, her vision of twins is very dark and very tricky. So it was very interesting. And I added many things to the book, some dark things I read about twins, especially all the end of the film was not in the book. It was very interesting for me to make some research about twins.
It's equally about a woman's sexuality as well. And I think it's quite uncommon, I think, with films that tackle the sexuality of a woman, especially when they're made by a man, to treat that sexuality with a degree of seriousness. I mean, it's not too serious. It's not po-faced or anything, but the sexual journey that she's on is quite legitimate.
First, I have no message. I have just a question to ask. But I've always been interested in sexuality in general. And for me, there is no difference between feminine and masculine sexuality. For me, it's the same thing. But I wanted to show that her sexuality was disturbed by her secret. And she's looking for the secret of malaise in life. And of course, sexuality was a good way to explore unconscious. And that was interested me. And I decided with this film to have no limits. I didn't want to censure myself, especially with bad or good tests. You know, I wanted to go very deeply. Actually, I wanted to go inside her body. And one of the first shots you have seen it is really inside her body. I wanted really to try to see very deep what happens. I don't have answer, I have just questions. And I think the film gives an opportunity to the audience to have his own vision of his girl and of her sexuality too.
You can be fairly certain that when you show certain things in the film, regardless of their merit in the script, that the audience will react a certain way simply because we're not used to seeing certain parts of the body doing certain things on the screen.
Of course. I'm always thinking to the audience, you know. My teacher in terms of relationship with the audience is Hitchcock. So I always asking myself, what do people think? They will be attracted, they will be repulsed, they will be shocked, they will be afraid. I'm always projecting the emotions of the audience, but sometimes I'm wrong. You know, I think this scene will be funny and actually people don't laugh at all and they are just shocked. So you never know. So it's always a surprise and you have to accept and to assume as a director that the film is no more your film. You know, it belongs to the audience. So it's very funny because when you speak with the audience, when you make a Q&A of these kind of things, there are many reactions, especially on my films. And sometimes when I hear people, I think, my God, I didn't want to make this film. I've made something else, but they have their own point of view. And actually, it's funny and it's interesting always to see how people make the film their own.
It's funny you mentioned Hitchcock just a little bit earlier, because at some moments during the film, I did find myself thinking, perhaps this is the kind of film that Hitchcock would have loved to have tackled were he alive in this era of filmmaking.
I think if Hitchcock was still alive, he would make porn movies. I'm sure of that, because he suffered a lot of censor. But actually, he made some beautiful movies because the censor was there and he was not capable to express exactly very directly, straight to the point, what he wanted to say sometimes, especially with the sex scenes. But he found some very good ideas to speak about sex and to show sex, not realistic sex. Today, for me as a director, I have more freedom. So, of course, I had the opportunity, especially for these films, to show some sexual scenes we had never seen before. So it was a real challenge and it was funny and exciting to work on that with the actors.
François Ozon speaking there to Monocle's Ben Rylan, and that film, L'Amant Double, is streaming now. It's part of Monocle's curated list of must-see French films in the new issue of the magazine, which is out on newsstands this week. That's it for this Monocle Daily. It was produced by Augustin Macellari and Ben Rylan. Our researcher, Daphne Karnesis, and Christy Evans was our studio manager. The Globalist here 8 hours from now at 7 a.m. London time, and the Daily back at 2200 in London tomorrow evening. For now, though, from me, Paul Osborne. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.